Thank you for joining us at the i3 Detroit Hour. Coming up, Nick Britsky and I talk about the crisis in Japan in the aftermath of the tsunami and ask our listeners to do their part by sending aid. Then I have a chat with two of our members, Bill Putt and John Sugg. We talk about our ambitions ranging from do-it-yourself soda fountain drinks to DIY television and airbrushing. All music we use in our program was found online under the Creative Commons license. To learn more about the music used in our program, please email us at contact@i3detroit.com. Thank you, and please enjoy the show. This is i3 Detroit.
And a 1, 2, 3, 4.
He was on the news, and here's this guy in Klingon, and he's talking Klingon, and I'm like, well, that's the guy we need, this guy for our skit. And we found his phone number somehow and called him up, and he's like, I'll do it for $50.
In the Pacific, our fellow hackers and human beings are in crisis. Here in the States, the spotlight has been on Japan and the aftermath of the earthquake, the tsunami it caused, and the failure of nuclear power plants in Fukushima, the hardest-hit area of the country. We ask our listeners to take action. Do a collection in your community for the basic needs of survival and the simplest human comforts, and send them to our colleagues at the Tokyo Hackerspace. A full list of requested materials is early in our program. After that, on a lighter note, I get to sit down and chew the fat with two members of i3 Detroit. Bill Putt shares his passion for podcasting and the Open Soda Project, an open source system for brewing your own soft drinks at home. After that, have you ever needed to hire a Klingon? One member of i3 Detroit did. John Sugg fills me in on the times he had making an amateur television show for local public broadcast. We also talk about his latest project, a regulation soft tip dartboard cabinet. All this and more, up next on the i3 Detroit Hour. Thank you for joining us for another installment of the i3 Detroit Hour. This is Ross Smith, and on the phone with me today is Nick Britsky.
Hey, everyone.
Nick is calling in from Delaware. He's out there, and I think he's going to make a little time to visit an area hackerspace. And that should be pretty exciting.
Yeah, there's Vintage Computers is out here. I reached out to them, and they said they were interested in me swinging by. You know, it's not nearly as big as i3, but certainly, you know, anything on the East Coast, space is quite a bit higher as far as rent goes.
Yeah, no, very understandable. So, very cool. What sort of, I take it they specialize in electronics with a name like that.
Yeah, they're much more computer-based, it looks like, than i3. They have like 1,800 square feet. So, I'm very curious to see. It actually looked like a computer recycler, the website. So, I was a little confused when I first checked it out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's sort of a natural place for people to come and tinker and look at some technology, and no doubt they would see a whole lot of different types coming through their hands. So, very neat.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's fun. One of the first events that i3 put on actually was a recycling event for computers way back when.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, you'll have to check that out and let us know how it goes, what you think.
Will do.
Awesome. So, unless we've been living under a rock, you've been hearing about everything going on in Japan, the really terrible disaster with the earthquake and the repercussions that's been having there. It's really shocking, and I'm still trying to wrap my brain around just the scope of it. We received a message from a particular hackerspace, actually. There's a Tokyo hackerspace, which is looking for some materials to help out their members and the people that they know and they care about just in their own relief effort. And I think I'd like to take a little time just to review the list of materials that they are requesting.
Absolutely.
So let's see. We were contacted by Akiba, who is one of their members, and we're rounding up at i3 Detroit a bunch of these materials to ship out on Monday. If anyone's interested, I'm sure you can find this information. I believe it's on Boing Boing. You can also reach us out to us at i3 Detroit, and we can help you if you want to get some other things sent out. The materials in particular that they are looking for are earplugs, earphones, eye masks, baby bottles, powdered baby formula, energy bars, portable water drinks, portable water tanks, excuse me, the collapsible kind, portable water filters, paper cups, lanterns, first aid kits, dust masks, soap, towels, blankets, gloves, flashlights, slippers, candles, lighters, pocket knives, trash bags, aspirins, basic painkillers, some sanitizing gels, and all manner of disposable eating and gear like paper plates, cups, spoons, forks, chopsticks, and the like. So all the basic things that you would really need just to survive in a short term, you know, away from your home, imagining, you know, that you had no access to your own kitchen, your own living room, what you would need to get by. I just can't even imagine the conditions that they're going through right now. It's terrible to contemplate.
Yeah, and kind of, I mean, again, granted, we've had nothing like this. We're in our neck of the woods. Back when we had that power outage, you know, 3-4 years ago, there were a couple things that started to get a little bit scarce, but I'm sure nothing to the extent that you're seeing over in Japan. And, you know, anything you can provide, certainly to help out the fellow hackerspaces. I know this podcast reaches a lot of people worldwide. And, if you can look up Boing Boing or i3 in Detroit, please help them out. You know, it's kind of all of our hackers. We all get together helping our own. And, I'm sure this is stuff you even have laying around, you know, your house, your apartment, your flat. You know, help out. I think it's a good cause. You know, certainly last year, Hackers on Flame went out to visit, the Tokyo Hackerspace. And it was just a year ago that they were seeing this pristine space. And, you know, now there's all this destruction and they could really use your help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're all people coming together in response to just this tremendous crisis. And as hackers, of course, we can band together. And there's nothing necessarily special about us being hackers, just that we really want to, you know, help our fellows. Absolutely. There is, I guess, something that we could try if we wanted to, you know, rise to the occasion. I think there are some plans out there for building DIY Geiger counters or radiation detection kits. So if there are materials and you have some expertise in that area, I'm sure that there are people who want to know this information, right, about how safe their environment is. You know, you can help them perhaps find that out if you can build or send or supply information to that effect to this Tokyo Hackerspace.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing you bring up is so the nuclear power plant is in the prefecture that's located in. Do you have that up on your screen?
I think it's in Fukushima is the area, right?
Fukushima, yeah. And how far is that from Tokyo? Is there going to be kind of you know, nuclear winds, if you will, that'll be traveling their way?
Oh my gosh, it can't really be that far. I mean, again, thinking about the size of Japan compared to like my sense of scale in the U.S., but I don't know exactly how far Fukushima is from Tokyo, but I did read some information when I was researching the subject saying that people in the U.S., experts in the U.S. looking at this said they would recommend people in Japan living within a 50-mile radius of Fukushima evacuate their homes. And to me, that's probably a very long distance, come to think of it, in terms of the scale of geography in Japan. I'm going to bring up a Google map, though, and see exactly how far that is from Tokyo.
Because I know that people, some people are actually nervous on the west coast of the U.S. And, you know, I don't know if those fears are, you know, true or not, or, you know, should be, you know, actually heeded. But it certainly sounds like that would be a long distance for that thing to, you know, the winds to travel. And certainly by the time it reached the Pacific Ocean, you know, across the Pacific Ocean, the largest body of water in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or in the world, it certainly would probably be fairly diluted.
Yeah, it's a good question. And from what I've read on the subject, the radiation that gets released from the events that we're seeing currently dissipates relatively quickly. And that it's not nearly as bad as sort of the dirty bomb effects that we're concerned about. Right. It's possible, I suppose. But I think what they're trying to prevent from happening is a sort of dirty nuke style release of radioactive material into the environment.
Yeah, and there's a lot of misconceptions about nuclear too. I mean, to low levels of nuclear material are kind of given off from a lot of things around, you know, the environment that are certainly way below anything that harm you. But it's all over the place. I mean, you know, just traveling in a plane, I heard actually, you know, just the dose of radiation I just received from flying into Philadelphia is something to look at. But, you know, the other thing that I did hear, I think on CNN is that, you know, the nuclear material in a reactor is completely different from the nuclear material in the bomb we dropped, you know, dropped on Hiroshima.
Yes.
It's not going to explode and, you know, completely devastate that area. I don't know what you read when you were talking about, you know, when you were looking through your research, but, it seems like, you know, some people have this misconception that, you know, nuclear power is just like a giant bomb just waiting to go off.
Yeah, that's I would imagine too a lot of the listeners on Signal have, you know, dug into this and done a lot of their own reading, but absolutely it's worth reviewing. what I've read has indicated that we're not at all concerned about sort of a nuclear fission event, right? So the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima, you know, the nuclear explosions were fission. They were enriched uranium, I believe, and there was a chain reaction where these uranium atoms were exploding and causing the ones neighboring them to explode and explode and so on. And that's actually very difficult to achieve. And when the reactor's primary power systems went offline in Fukushima, one of the very first things that happened was these, what they're called control rods, were inserted into the bed where all of the fuel rods were to absorb the radiation causing the fission. So the nuclear fission in a power plant like this is caused when uranium is, like, neutrons are flying around and being released, and they're hitting uranium atoms and others, and they cause them to break apart and explode, which releases more neutrons, and they just keep causing each other to explode. These control rods were inserted as a safety measure once power was cut off, and those control rods absorbed all those free neutrons which were causing that fission reaction. So that sort of put out the primary fire more or less immediately. Now our concern is that there are a lot of residual chain reactions taking place, and these are releasing a whole lot of heat, and that heat is going to build up the pressure inside of the fuel rods so that they might explode like popcorn. And when they do pop like that, if they don't get cooled off, that's going to release a lot of very hazardous radioactive material into the environment. And that makes it kind of like a dirty bomb. It's dispersing dangerous material, but it's not the same as like a fission event which causes a nuclear explosion in a mushroom cloud.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's actually a very fascinating read. There's this semi-controversial blog post out there floating around where someone who claims to be an expert on the subject wrote in great detail, and this is the article that I read, about how these boiling water nuclear power plants work. And it was later revised by some experts at MIT saying, you know, well, you've got about half of the facts right, and then they changed it up some. And in there, they explained in some detail how these plants work as far as the lines of defense against an event exactly like this. So the authorities in Japan are dumping an enormous amount of water onto the power plant in order to continue to keep it cool, so that if the radioactive energy there continues to kick out heat, it's going to be dissipated by this seawater that's being dumped and prevents that type of explosion, which would disperse radioactive material.
Yeah. There are so many misconceptions, I feel like, with nuclear power. I feel like it's something that, is a step up from some of the more fossil fuels that we've been burning. And we haven't built a nuclear power plant in the U.S. in some 30 or 40 years. And I know the nuclear lobby has really been pushing for this to happen. But I'm not sure if it's a combination of just people's fears or, what to do with the kind of the radioactive waste once it's, kind of been spent.
Mm-hmm.
But I was actually listening to, of all things, kind of conservative radio as I was driving around Pittsburgh.
Oh, that must have been a trip.
Yeah. I like listening to NPR and, just kind of like it's a friendly voice in the car. And up comes, Sean Hannity and all his fiery rap. And, one of the things he was kind of talking about is, nuclear reactor, why aren't there more nuclear power plants in the U.S.? It was actually weird to be on the same side of a discussion as Sean Hannity.
Yeah, conservative radio voicing an opinion that you tend to side with. I don't typically associate that experience myself. I know what you're saying. Yeah, a nuclear power, honestly, to me, is a solution that we should be pursuing a bit more. There's so much fear around it, though, in that people don't, I guess they don't really understand the difference between a nuclear fission event, right, and simply the danger of a radioactive substance. And certainly, the waste created is a problem, but we're enterprising and we have landfills and we find ways to deal with massive amounts of trash. And I can imagine we can deal with radioactive waste too.
Yeah, and people are just so ignorant. I mean, not everyone, but, the time that you took to do a little bit of research on this took you 20 minutes to read up and do some of this stuff. And it bugs me a little bit that people would just assume that, nuclear power is bad and evil, where they could hit up a couple articles online and, at least get some background to kind of make a little bit more of an educated decision.
Right. Exactly. And that's, doing research is always, it's never fun, right? I mean, you always want to take the sort of canned answer that's given to you when you read a news article that poses a question and then answers it for you at the same time. It makes everything read, you know, so easy. It makes it so simple to have an opinion. But the more that you dig and the more that you read, especially about something like nuclear power like this, you realize it's layered, you know, it's complex. There are lots of consequences. And the same can be said, honestly, of coal. I know there have been a lot of advances in making coal a little cleaner and that there are some, you know, ways of making that technology better as long as we are using it, etc. But yeah, it's those sorts of complex policy issues that I liked depending on an expert to help sort out, because the expert has put a lot of time into studying and understanding the subject, and I don't feel entitled to an opinion, you know? I think people are just often entitled to their opinions because they want to have them, you know?
No, they are, and people are set in their ways, and that's just they think what they want to think.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thank you for catching up with me, Nick, and reviewing. I really hope everyone out there listening is interested in putting together a care package to send to someone they know in Japan or to the Tokyo Hackerspace. Again, I think the information for that is posted on Boing Boing if you want to go check it out. You can also go to i3detroit.com and get in touch with us, and we'll help you if you want to coordinate with us. But please think about your fellows in need in Japan.
Yep. No, I can't harp enough that this is a really good cause. And again, this is, you know, not just some faceless entity that is in need, which not saying that those individuals aren't a worthy cause, but, you know, these are your fellow hackers. And they're reaching out to you right now saying that, you know, here's the things they need. Very simple stuff that I'm sure you can drive down to your local Target or Walmart or, you know, whatever European supermarket that might be available. You know, please help them out. And, I think they'll really appreciate it. And certainly, and if we ever have the same situation here or, you know, in Europe or Australia or Canada, you know, that I think they would come and do the same for us.
I hope so. All right. Well, great. Thank you very much, Nick, for taking some time and talking to me today.
Thank you. And until next month, I guess.
Until then.
Hi, Ross.
Hey, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm just dandy.
Great. Glad to hear it. Thank
Yay.
You for joining me. This is the i3 Detroit Hour, and we're just getting a couple perspectives from our members.
Excellent.
Life in general, life
Excellent.
At i3, projects.
So, hey, speaking of projects at i3, mm-hmm. we're using a project that I made at i3.
Yes. This is one of my favorite projects.
So, there's talk of making a big trailer for podcasting and videocasting, and I thought that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I need to do podcasts from here.
Yes, exactly.
But want to minimize setup time. So I built this slick little four-person podcast mobile rig that we can hang on the wall. And so, Ross, I think you're the only other person besides me who's used it so far.
I've gotten a fair amount of use out of it, yeah. I don't know if Nick has busted it out or Nate has, but yeah, I think you and I are the main people who
yeah.
bust this thing out. I really like it. It's got a very compact mixing board with, it looks like, four input channels and four outputs, four mics. It's a great little setup here, and a whole bunch of outputs running to the computer, headphones, etc. So
yeah, the outputs are a little... I'd like to get those cleaner, but I can't think of a way to get get those cleaner and have the versatility.
Yes.
So, but it works. You can just set it down, plug in. You know, we can be set up for our show in 15 minutes if I'm running late.
Yeah, exactly. The setup time I've noticed for me, it's down to maybe 10 or 15
yeah.
minutes tops.
Yeah.
And for the quality that you get, it's very
yeah.
very good.
Yeah.
Especially now that we have these, so pop filters.
Yeah, we got pop filters now. Huzzah!
Yeah.
And I have noticed that I have four separate mics. Actually, I think those two mics are the same, but all the rest of the mics are like different.
Yeah, they're different mics.
So I can tell this. I can tell what mic I'm on when I'm listening back to our show. I'm like, oh, I'm on the gray one. Oh, I'm in the black one. So eventually, I want to get the same mics, but maybe a little better quality. So.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about that last time, I think. Yeah, one of the mics has a very, very slightly. Tinny sound to it.
This is the tinny one I'm on.
The one that you're on? Okay.
Yeah, that's the silver one. So.
Yeah.
And so I also want to introduce my co-host for our show, the show we do later, Tony here. He's a member just joined last month, or this month.
Oh, you're a member now.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah,
member Tony, everybody.
I gave Nate the check right before New Year's, and it's got me going. So yeah, I'm a member now, so I don't have to keep hitting the little buzzy button. And yeah,
what the button
just
went
after,
in
just after I became a member, you decided to put a doorbell on the
day
wall.
Exactly. The day he joined, that's when the buzzer started working.
I remember too. I remember one of the first times you came in here to do the podcast, and you were just beating on the door like, "Let me in,"
because you're all in the back cutting something up, and I was like, "Oh, I'm trying to get in."
Yeah, we're ripping, like, you know, gigantic pieces of lumber on the Unisaw, and for some reason, we can't hear someone knocking. It's just the strangest thing.
We got loud sounds going on, yeah.
So now we have a doorbell that, like, wakes the dead.
Yeah.
When you're in the loft, and you're right next to it, it's a small heart attack.
Exactly.
When that thing goes off.
And everyone's like, oh, I gotta push it for a long time.
Yeah, we need
to just tap it.
It's very whimsical, I gotta say. What we did, Ted Hansen took this easy button, the one that you can find.
The stapler's easy button.
Exactly. It's the staple's easy button. So when you hit it, it goes, that was easy. And he ripped out the electronics, and he turned it into a doorbell, and he mounted it to the front of our building next to the man door into our warehouse, and wired it up to the doorbell that's built into our warehouse here. The problem is that doorbell, my God, is it loud.
It used to be in the kitchen, what we use as the kitchen. I don't know what it used to be. But it obviously used to call the shop when the shop was, like, you know, active all the time. So.
And you've got machines running. Yeah, I think I once
found out. I mean, if you turn on all our machines at the same time, you could still hear that bell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a throwback to the day. I think the company who used to be in our space manufactured screws. So they had a whole bunch of, like, milling and lathes and stuff like that. And they just were constantly running.
Oh, yeah.
So you needed that. But now, whenever someone rings the doorbell, it's ungodly loud.
It's a hacker space, so I'm sure somebody can come up with something better.
Now that we've got a button outside, we can hook that button to all kinds of different things. We
can
have like an MP3 player play a sound like someone's at the door. Hey,
exactly.
You know,
we can have like a clown honk a hoot. We can do. We got
Twitter ball,
options.
You know, have the disco light turn on when people hit the thing.
There we go. Yes.
I like the disco ball
for Twitter, the disco ball for the doorbell. You know. Maybe we should just like have a dance. We should have, you know, a disco in here all the time.
The dance,
Friday night disco party. The
dance will keep going as long as people keep twittering about i3.
Yes, exactly. The dance continues.
So
a good PR day brings us all out and we celebrate.
So another project I've been working on lately that should be really awesome for everyone is I bought an old pop machine.
Yes.
I make my own soda, which we're going to have a class here at i3 on February 12th.
I saw it on the schedule. I'm very excited.
Making open soda. So
now, can you tell everyone about open soda?
The open soda is a project that stemmed from both Pingwicon and Open Cola. One of the founding members of Open Cola, which was a software company that made a recipe on how to make your own cola, and then gave them out as, at trade shows and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that founding member was Cory Doctorow, and he was coming to Pingwicon.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Excuse me. So Cory Doctorow was showing up, and my friend Matt was like, we need to make a batch of this. And we're like, okay.
and he got me roped
into it. What's that?
For those who don't know what Pingwicon is, it's a convention. Put on this particular convention is specifically for the computer.
Well, it's half open source, half science fiction.
Right, half open source, Linux, Ubuntu, anything open source, open office, and then you have your sci-fi people that come in and do that, and gaming and all that.
And there's a surprising intersection in those demographics.
Yes,
that's how it started.
Ah.
And there's some people, you know, every single year, I used to be heavily involved in running PingwinCon, and every single year, half the people were like, there's too much science fiction, I won't go because there's too much science, and then the other half was like, the exact same year, there's way too much
computer science.
There's too much computers. I'm not going. There's too much computer.
Right.
And it's like, we don't want the fringe. We want the intersection.
Yep.
But Pingwicon has always strived to be the one-stop geek shop. And every year, we do more and more and more. So to the point now, we have a food tract.
Really?
We actually schedule food events, including the open soda, which started at Pingwicon. So me and Matt and a beer guy made a batch of the original open cola.
Mm-hmm.
The methodology was horrible. The terminology was horrible. The recipe was horrible. The final product was horrible.
Mm.
Like, we have to redo this from the ground up.
Yikes.
So we got another guy in who was very good at chemistry, and we just totally rebuilt everything from the ground up. So,
everything about the process, the chemicals you use,
The chemicals are similar.
Okay.
But there's differences in exactly what you get that aren't mentioned in the original Open Cola documentation that are extremely important.
I gotcha.
That they gloss over.
How does one make soda?
The key element of making soda is binding oil to water.
Okay.
The principal ingredients inside of a standard soda is you got your sweetener,
mm-hmm.
your water,
mm-hmm.
your flavoring, and your acids.
Right.
And you have to mix those all together. Everything mixes fine except the water and oil. Oil doesn't like water. So you have to have gum arabic
mm-hmm.
to mix the two.
Glue.
Emulsion.
Oh, I see. Right,
yeah.
Right.
So you have to create an emulsion between the oils and the waters.
I see. Gotcha.
And this is you have to have the gum arabic exactly right. And this was one of the problems with the original thing, is that you have to have it you have to soak it in water first before you use it. No one ever said that. But you have to soak it overnight in water. Bloom. That's the term I'm trying to. You have to bloom the alginate before you can use it.
I see.
Otherwise, it doesn't stick. So we found this specifically designed gum arabic that is used in the beverage industry that is pre-bloomed.
Ah.
You can just use it in its powder form as is.
And is there a big price differential? Like, is there an obvious
yes.
reason why?
Okay. Yes, there is a big price differential. We go, hey, we would like a sample of your gum arabic. And they send us a container, which we used. The first one got used up in the span of 5 years, making kegs and kegs and kegs.
Wow.
As a quote-unquote sample. We would love to buy from them. The smallest they will sell us is a 50-pound bag, which
would probably keep you in soda for the rest of your years.
So until we get up to a vastly better, vastly bigger industry within inside there, it's not a thing we want to try. So, but anyway, so we've come up with several methodologies for improving the emulsion process. One of them is oils are, the essential oils we use are alcohol soluble.
Mm-hmm.
So we mix it with a little tiny bit of vodka, not enough to make the alcohol, make the final product alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
but enough to break them down and make it easier to create, put into emulsion.
Very interesting.
And then the final step is we were originally just dumping sugar in hot water and then calling in a syrup. That's not really what you need. What you need to do is break down the chemical bonds of table sugar, which is a disaccharide, into monosaccharides, for a half an hour in the presence of an acid.
I see. So that all results cumulatively in a flavor that's much more like a real
exactly.
So
we're extremely close to having pop that you couldn't tell the difference. You can tell the difference with our current thing,
mm-hmm.
but it's so minutely different that it's almost not a difference. So.
And besides the change in your bloomed alginate, it sounds like it's a methodological change. It's not really that much of a major difference in materials then.
No. But knowing how to use the materials properly
exactly.
is a big thing. And in fact, I discovered some other things that I want to try in the next dev session, we call them,
mm-hmm.
To try to improve the process even more. So
that's awesome.
It's always a little bit more knowledge every single time.
Now, if someone wants to learn more about Open Soda, where should they go?
Opensoda.org.
Cool.
I have a website. I have all the recipes. I have how-to videos. So
cool.
Everything is up there.
Sweet, man.
Yes,
well,
yes.
You'll have to share some with us. And I don't know. I think it might actually be a very good Maker Faire project. And, you know, coming full circle.
Yeah, it was last year. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, coming full circle, you have a project which is a soda dispenser on
yes.
wheels.
Yes.
And I've seen you've been working on this recently, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about
it. So the back in the 80s, everyone used what they called pre-mix systems. You mix the soda, you mix the syrup with the soda water
mm-hmm.
before you serve it. And you have to carry around these big 5-gallon kegs. And everyone knows the big 5-gallon kegs I'm talking about because they're currently used for home brew beer.
Ah.
But those weren't made for beer. They were made for pop, but the pop industry doesn't use them anymore, so you can get them really cheap.
Gotcha.
I'm using them for pop again. What everyone uses now is bag and box, which is a post-mix system. If you ever
right.
go up to a fountain and get some cola,
mm-hmm.
you can see stripes of brown and stripes of white. That's the soda and the syrup mixing in your cup.
Yep, I remember that, actually. I used to work in a cafeteria and had to change those boxes.
Yes,
out.
Yes.
Yeah.
So eventually, I would like to have one of those systems here,
mm-hmm.
but you can't guarantee the water supply at conventions where it's just where I usually do the dispense the soda
right.
and also Maker Faire. So you have to do a pre-mix system so you can guarantee your water supply.
And besides, it's just so cool that you can just
yes.
wheel around four
yes.
fountain drinks at a time.
Yes.
You know, wherever you want to take them.
Actually, I don't think you saw my cart system I made. The one that I brought in here is a professionally made by the big company is Cornelius, mm-hmm. Which you it's on wheels and you plug it into the water supply and it cools. It's got a refrigerator in there. It cools the pop down as it's coming out. What I did before I found this machine, which is they're rare and they're big, so they're hard to they're expensive to ship. Mm-hmm. So it's the first one I found around this area at all.
Right.
Before that, what I did is I bought a chill plate, which you put a bunch of ice on top of it, you run your pop through it, and it chills it down that way. Mm-hmm. So I made my own cooler, and I made it on one of those carts, like that gray cart. Who makes it? Plexi? Not. I can't think of the name of it now, but the Rubbermaid. The Rubbermaid carts.
Oh, yes, yes.
So I actually cut holes in the top of it so I can put my kegs in, mm-hmm. and I put the cooler on a track so you could move it away from the kegs, change up the kegs, and put it out. So this whole thing will move. It's heavy as crap. Mm-hmm. It moves slowly, but I could have the whole thing in one self-contained moving cart.
Self-contained functionality is your mainstay, Bill. I get this feeling. We've got our self-contained podcasting station, our self-contained soda dispensing station.
I was very modular.
I'm lazy.
I will too.
I will go through great lengths and much work to be lazy in the future. So yeah. So
you make a very good programmer, by the way. That's very much what it's all about.
Yeah, yeah. So the original reason I did the cart is I just wanted to wheel it out of my van, mm-hmm. and wheel it up into Consuite and be done.
Right.
Because before then we had to get a couple carts, lug everything onto the carts, lug it up, and I was like, this is a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. So what I've been doing this whole week is this professional one I bought was just really rusty, really dirty, needed a lot of work.
It all looked like a cosmetic sort of negligence.
Oh, yeah.
There was
no physical damage. It functioned, mm-hmm. except for the motor. We took out the motor, which stirs up the water. Mm-hmm. That was so rusty it wouldn't turn anymore.
Ooh.
But I took it all apart. I sandblasted it. And I'm like, well, the worst it's going to do is not work. And it doesn't work now.
Well, there you go. Exactly. No harm done.
And I put it all back together, mm-hmm. and Big Nate helped me set up a thing in the E-Lab for safely testing it, and it worked. It worked just fine after I sandblasted it. So everything is in working order now.
Oh, fantastic.
I just have to do the final rinse out of the tub and put it all back together.
Very cool.
So,
now, I'm curious. Are you going to participate in any of the upcoming airbrush classes?
I wasn't planning on it because I'm not a very good artistic person.
Well, you can contract it out then, yeah.
Oh, exactly. I would love to. Actually, Rocco is probably going to help me with the vinyl cutter.
Oh.
Because I've got a logo all ready to go, which will cut out and put on the soda dispenser.
That would be perfect, yeah, because then you can get a very sophisticated design and it would look like, you know, the real bona fide.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's got Pepsi logos on the side right now, mm-hmm. and I couldn't figure out how to pull the plastic off, so I'm going to figure out what to do with there, but yeah. we're gonna trick it out with the Open Soda logo. So
very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bill, I want to appreciate. I thank you very much for.
Oh yeah.
Talking to me
today. I love talking about myself.
Absolutely. Well.
And my projects.
Yes. Well, the projects, they're super cool, and you're not so bad yourself. Any parting words?
If you want to check out the podcast we do from i3 on a weekly basis, you can go to dementiaradio.org/podcast, and it's all up there.
Yes, and this is Elevating the Toad Hour, right?
Toad Elevating Moment.
Toad Elevating Moment.
Yes, it's a comedy radio show and a lot of geek talk as well.
All right, awesome. And you can also check out opensoda.org if
you
want to learn more about that project.
There you go.
All right, thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Ross.
I used to have a TV show years ago when so I work in the cable television business. So we used to have studios, you know, they're right in there where you work.
Mm-hmm.
So you would you'd get off work at 5 o'clock and you could just walk into this room and make your own TV show.
That's
so
awesome. Where did you work?
I worked for a little company in Birmingham. It was called Booth Communications. It's owned by a place, a family in Grosse Pointe.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a mom and pop cable company, but you could, you could make your own TV show. So like a Wayne's World show.
Nice.
And they would just walk in there and it was great.
Like plunk down and move your props and your furniture in or whatever. Yeah. And just turn on the cameras and go.
But we had no crew.
Okay.
So we literally would have to, we'd have to turn on the camera, walk in front of it, sit down, do your little bit, and then come back out and turn the camera off.
Nice.
Yeah, no crew whatsoever, zero.
How similar does that sound to anything we do with a webcam now, right? I mean, like YouTube is basically just you reach for it, you flip on the camera, you know? But it was, but it was still, it's really awesome. There's a place you could do that before web cameras and all that. That's pretty slick.
Yeah, well, I mean, how
many people were in your show?
Two.
Two? Okay.
That's it. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Co-hosts.
Right.
Like a lot like Wayne, a lot like Wayne's World, but, you know, we're hosting movies.
Okay.
So we got public access or public domain is what I'm trying to say. So you get like a public domain film and then, we just host that and a lot of editing afterwards and it was pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. So, cool. When did it air? Was it like?
Oh, a long time ago. Late 90s.
Okay. But like at 2 a.m. or like, you know, 1 a.m. or like when would it be?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure what time it was on, but I know they loved it in the public access world because it was like a hour and a half, two hour show.
Okay.
So for a playback operator, that's a really good thing. It's like that long song for a DJ where they just play that really long song and then you got a break or a lunch or whatever. So
right, yeah.
So
pretty sweet, man.
Yeah.
Well, cool. We're in the i3 Detroit Hackerspace now, and it's not a TV show. We're podcasting, but that's still fun. I like that. This is Ross Smith, and I'm talking to John Sugg. And yeah, I appreciate you taking some time to talk to me today. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your project here, which I think is one of the most well-finished projects I've seen, like, done around here at this place.
Oh, thank you. My project is it's a dartboard cabinet, you know, soft tip dartboard. So if you've ever been to a bar, right, and then they have the coin op, you put the coins in there, and you play soft tip darts. So it's basically that same thing, and I was given the dartboard. That dartboard is from around, I don't know, late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it outputs its scoring to video.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically took that idea, and then I designed a cabinet for this dartboard around, you know, the fact that it had to have the dartboard itself and a video screen to output the scoring.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it's all of your own design.
Sort of. I mean, if you go on the internet and look up Arachnid English Mark Darts, I think it's called Super 6, you'll see something. It's almost exactly the same. So it's a bit of I designed the cabinet to fit around, you know, the parts that I had, but it's sort of a copy of an existing or, you know, 20-year-old coin-op soft tip dart machine.
Gotcha. And that makes some sense. As I understand it, there are like a lot of regulations when you're playing darts, like, you know, for a tournament, for example, you have to have the dartboard at a certain height and you have to have the screens or the tips, you know, in a certain fashion.
Right.
So copying a design probably went a long way to meeting those regulations.
Right. So I had to research, you know, how high is the bullseye have to be off the ground and to design the cabinet, you know, right down to the last millimeter, how that was going to fall into place and still a dartboard at the right altitude, including a little adjustable metal feet on the bottom, you know, or 1 inch tall. And you take all that into consideration. So it had to be fairly precise when I drew it up. But, after that, it worked out pretty good.
It's
coming together.
It definitely did. Yeah. I wish we could, you know, package a picture up with this, but it's a great looking black painted cabinet. It's got this red edge trim all along. So it's got this bright black and red contrast to it, which is of course very appropriate for the dartboard, which, you know, has those colors. The monitor output looks really good. The TV in the corner. It's like maybe, what's the diameter on that television? It's like 5 inches.
I think it's only 5, but the original, you know, dartboard looked a lot like that. Almost all the parts are pretty much donated, like the board was given to me by my stepson. The wood came from a free cycler. They wanted to get rid of a piece of MDF, medium density fiber board.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I might have paid $5 for that little TV at a garage sale. So I've been collecting these parts over the past couple of years, and they've just been sitting around. So when I signed up to be an i3 member And Ted said to Ted Hansen asked me, you know, what's the first thing you're going to, what's your first build going to be? And I said, oh, I'm going to build this dartboard. So that's it. So,
awesome. Cool. Yeah. Any idea what you want to do next? Is it, have you got a queue going?
I do have a queue, and I've forgotten some of the things on it, but at home I have almost a full page of stuff that I could.
Wow.
I have more ideas than I have time.
Oh my God, yes. I know exactly what you mean.
They're not expensive ideas, because you can build stuff and not spend a lot of money on it. You know, if you do, if you plan properly. But I do have a long list of things. I'd like to build something for the Maker Fair, you know, that's coming up this summer. So
yeah, yeah.
If you start early enough, you know.
Yeah, you can make a tremendous project, absolutely. Right. And that reminds me actually what you said. You can make a ton of great projects for cheap or free, and that was the motto of one of the presenters at Maker Faire Detroit last year, who showed a whole audience, one person in the audience being me, how to make a backyard metal furnace, or like, you know, smelting pot.
Right.
Obviously, I didn't pay very close attention, or I would remember the terminology, but it allowed you to melt down all sorts of metal elements and then, you know, cast them. So you could do metal casting in your backyard with this furnace that's essentially made out of like an aluminum trash can with a bunch of like concrete liner parts. And it shows you how you can find all the handles and all the, like gripping pieces and poking bits that you need to, essentially for free or for very, very cheap, you know. And he's made all sorts of cast metal parts and projects for very little money by reusing, scrap metal, you know.
That was a really popular exhibit. It was right next to the Mentos thing, wasn't it?
It was, yep.
A lot of people were over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was, I want to say, kitty corner from the I3 Detroit tent. Yeah, so
yeah.
It was. It was a lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to that. I don't know what exactly we're going to see at this year's Maker Faire Detroit. Certainly more, I'm hoping, you know, much bigger showing.
Right.
Very cool.
Now, did you, last year, did you spend, how much time did you spend preparation for Maker Faire?
I was
a member at that time.
Yeah, I'd say Maker Faire came together kind of quickly, I want to say. And by that I mean, like, there's a whole lot of prep work that happens in the couple months running up to it, an enormous amount of work, which to me seems like fast. Like, I would expect an organization like Make or an event like Maker Faire to take 6 months to prepare for. Like, it seems to me like a very large-scale event. But I guess it comes together pretty quickly. And my personal investment in that was about one night. I was roped in by Russ and Nick. Roped in maybe is not the best word, but I was invited by Russ and Nick to participate in their project, which was the Twinkie car that year.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, and it's sort of a child project, I guess, of the cupcake car. Did you ever see the cupcake car?
I've seen pictures of it, but I've never seen the real cupcake car.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a fleet, I guess, at a previous Maker Faire of all these cupcake vehicles that people, like, pedaled or powered with motors, and they sat inside them and they drove around. And there are these great pictures you can find, you know, on Flickr and on Make's site of all these people, you know, just lined up, just cupcake cars going all down the line, people poking up and looking at the camera. And I think one of those was from I3 Detroit, or at least we built one very much like that. So the Twinkie car was kind of the sequel, you know. It's like, how do we elevate this, you know, mobile pastry concept.
Right.
A really funny idea. But they needed someone to paint it, and that's where I came in, because I do a lot of airbrush and I do a lot of spray painting. And they said, do you want to help out? And I said, sure. So that was like a Thursday before Maker Faire. I was here at I3 from, I want to say, like 2 p.m. until about 4:30 in the morning, doing the base coat, building up a lot of colors, doing the logo for the Twinkie on the side, and all that good stuff.
Wow.
But that was the only thing I really spent a lot of time on. I had to be out of town that weekend for most of Maker Faire. I can't remember what for, but we were there for the last day.
Yeah.
And that's when I got to drive the Twinkie around, which was fun.
And my first class is coming up that I'm going to attend, and you're going to teach it. And
yes,
that
I am.
Is the airbrush class.
Yes, so, indeed. Yeah, there are a lot of folks who are really interested, I guess, in dressing up their projects and getting into painting with the airbrush, and you know, I'm very happy to share that. Airbrush is tricky, you know. It takes a lot of care.
Like it.
A lot. It takes a lot of maintenance. You know, the tools, they damage easily if you don't clean them every time that you use them.
Okay.
And that's the main thing that this first class is going to be about, is just how do you take care of an airbrush? How do you change paints? How do you make sure you don't make one of the billions of little possible mistakes when you're making a painting with airbrush? But once you get past that stuff, it's really fun. So.
Wow.
Now, I'm curious what your interest is with it. I've been asking people who are going to take the class kind of what their first goal is once they learn how to pick it up and use it, so that I can sort of speak to that. You know, there are so many things you can do.
Well, since I'm building this cabinet for the dartboard, it'd probably look good to have some side art. So I'm thinking, I don't even know what the side art's going to look like, but I still have a little bit of time to figure that out. But I think that's what it's going to be. And of course, there'll have to be some practice runs before
absolutely
the real application. But I think that's it.
Yeah, you will want to spend a little bit of time planning it out for sure. Yeah. As much planning as you can put into it, it'll all pay off when you sit down to do the actual painting. It's kind of a technical art form in that you're always rewarded for the degree you prepare by. Like, if you prepare a ton, you cut a lot of frisket, it's much easier to do a successful painting without much effort.
Wow.
So, yeah, absolutely. We have a vinyl plotter here, too, which is pretty fun. So you can actually take, like, a design. Do you know how to use, like, Illustrator or...
No, I've not done that.
Okay,
but
yeah.
This cuts the thing. It cuts it out of vinyl, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really neat. I love these machines. I've never really had a chance to play with one before I came here. It's like a printhead that's got all these different blades in it, and it just goes back and forth, and it cuts shapes out of vinyl. And you can just pop the shapes you cut out. You sort of weed out all the little, you know, islands of plastic that you don't care for, and you can use that, like, as a sticker, or you can use it as a mask for airbrush.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so when you're airbrushing and you want to get a nice crisp edge on the shape that you're painting, you need to mask it off somehow. And you can do it a few different ways, and one of them is the very painstakingly manual process where you draw out your shape, and then you take an X-Acto and you use exactly the right amount of hand pressure to cut, you know, so that you don't gouge your, you know, painting surface, but you do cut the mask. Or you just use a vinyl plotter, and in 10 minutes you're done. So,
good.
I'm hoping that'll be working in time for the class, so that I can show people how much time they can save if they have a really complex painting, if they can get the paths in a digital format first.
Wow, sounds good.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to it. Now let's go back a little to your experience with TV. I had no idea that you did that. I know that you've worked
in. Right. Well, that was just a fun thing, you know, after work, like I said, 5 o'clock, and you walk into the, you know, you're done with work, so you walk into the studio and you build your own, and you make your own show.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we had some special effects. I think the, we had a skit that was a Star Trek skit. And of course, the budget's really small, and you're just making like a YouTube video would be now, you know, you don't have a lot of budget for this stuff.
Mm.
So we had no set. So what we did was we bought the little play set for the action figures, and that was our set. And we just, we chroma keyed ourselves into that miniature action figure set.
That's awesome.
In fact, we even had a dual layer chroma key shot where, in fact, I hired a Klingon that I saw on TV, and I found the guy, and he agreed to be a Klingon for our show for like $50 or something.
So how did that work? You turned on the television and you saw like an ad for a local car dealership or something, and you said like, right there, that's our Klingon.
Well, sort of. He was on the news, and here's this guy in Klingon, and he's talking Klingon, and I'm like, well, that's the guy we need, this guy for our skit.
Right.
And we found his phone number somehow and called him up, and he's like, I'll do it for $50. Cause, you know, it does take him a while to put all this makeup on.
Sure. Yeah. Makeup and the whole day for the shoot. Yeah.
Done. You know, you can have, we'll pay you. So we had to get this guy, you know, on Star Trek, you've got the Klingons are always on the big screen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had to get this guy onto the screen. Well, the screen's a little model. It's only 5 inches across, maybe.
Yeah. Cause this is the playset we're talking about.
Yeah. So you've got to not only chroma key that guy onto the screen, but you've also got to have a background behind him. So we had a chroma key the actor onto a background, which was a photograph out of a magazine, a bunch of old Klingons. And then we had a chroma key that image onto the little screen on the little action play image. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. A little action figure, you know, set of the Enterprise.
Right.
And we did that with just a miniature piece of chroma key cloth. We took the thing apart and put it in there. Turned out fabulous, you know. We were chroma keyed onto the seats of the bridge.
Right, yeah.
Of the, this is the, you know, the next generation.
Oh, gotcha. This is TNG. So, gotcha.
Right, so.
Man, so then this was all with the hardware type chroma key
process. Yes, this was blue.
Yeah.
Not the green that you see around here. So it was blue chroma key. But,
right. And you know. Well, but more to my point, it's not like a software-based thing where you have some application that just is like, okay, drop this channel color and then swap these things in.
Not
that easy.
No, it didn't work as good as that. But it was, I don't remember it being difficult to use.
Okay.
You know, but yeah, it worked.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it worked good.
Those would be priceless if those are kicking around somewhere.
If only I could add. I had to fine-tune the editing on them. Would be really nice if I could find where the tapes are. And that would be a good YouTube video.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of funny stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My dad has done a lot of transfer-type work. He is the family archivist at this point. And as we've inherited a lot of slides and a lot of, like, 8mm film reels, you know, from vacation days and times gone by from his own family, he's figured out ways to, you know, do wall projections and do keystone correction and record it with a video camera so that he can archive all that film footage, which is very delicate, you know, onto a digital format and keep it. There's got to be a way we could capture that. I would love to see that sort of, you know, homemade homebrew Star Trek episode.
Oh, yeah. It's actually pretty good. And in a lot of the material, we kind of borrowed some of this stuff from, like, Mad Magazine, you know. That was their inspiration for some of the names, you know.
I was going to ask what the plot of the episode was, yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember all the details. I want to say this was 12, 13 years ago. But I know we encountered some Klingons, and our spaceships were, they were the Christmas ornaments, the Hallmark Christmas ornaments.
Oh, of like the Enterprise?
You know, they're about, how long are they? 4 or 5 inches?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, so... And then we needed a star field in the background, and that came from a Star Trek, one of those games that you play, like, you know, you get those DVD, interactive DVD trivia games.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically one of those.
Kind of like Seen It.
But then. I think it came from like a VHS version or something, and that's where we got the star field in the background to fly the ships on,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it was a little tricky to get all this stuff in place, but...
But it paid off.
It paid off pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I had to rent costumes and all that, but it worked pretty good.
That's
our
awesome.
Editing was a little bad at the end, but that could be fixed, you know.
Well, so. Yeah, and that's also, again, before the days of, like, nonlinear editing. You probably had to edit that, again, with hardware and in a straight sequential process. I've never done that myself, but I know that it's much more challenging.
Right, yeah, it's not as easy as now a computer... with editing on computers now.
Yep. So. We should figure something out here at i3. We have Bill Putt, one of our members, who in fact created the podcasting rig that we're using right now. Thank you, Bill. He set up green screens on one side of our space, and they're all rolled up, and they're on the top of our 16-foot ceiling, you know, and, you know, hanging from the girders that are up there. And if you spool it out, it goes all the way down to the floor, and it's a gigantic field. We could do a lot of video here if we wanted to get into it, you know.
Right.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. This is really very cool. If you can find that footage, I would be very happy to help you edit that.
Okay. Yeah. It needs a re-edit. So when I wasn't there during the final edit, and some of the scenes run like a half a second too long. So it's like in, what movie was it? The Jerk, you know, it's like cut.
Right.
You know,
and it keeps going.
And they didn't say cut at the right time. It's a little bit like that. So if the editing was tightened up, then it would work. It would flow, really.
Yeah. Right. And thankfully, removing footage is much easier than adding it. So.
Right.
Cool.
So.
All right. Well, thank you, John.
Ryan, thanks for having me.
Thanks to Nick Britsky, Bill Putt, and John Sugg for joining me this week. Tune in next month for more tales from i3 Detroit. Until then.